Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. So how do you document history if a lot of that history has been hidden from the outside world? That's the challenge and the life's work of Josh Burford, who has set out to tell the LGBTQ history of the South. Josh has done a lot of his work in North Carolina, but he's headed back to his home state of Alabama to work on a project called Invisible Histories, which he hopes to take throughout the South to archive the stories of LGBTQ pioneers. On this episode of Southbound, Josh and I talk about the pull of history and the political act of coming out. Josh reads from a 100-year-old diary found at the thrift store. And we also talk about a little bit of college football. Here's our conversation. So, Josh, we got to clear something up right at the beginning here.
Okay.
You are went to the University of Alabama.
I did.
Roll Tide, I guess.
Roll Tide, indeed, okay. Yeah.
I, on the other hand, represent the forces of light, having gone to the University of Georgia.
Yes.
We are recording this podcast 5 days before the national championship game
in which
Georgia will play Alabama, but this will not air until a couple of days after the game in which Georgia plays Alabama. So if you have any predictions, any thoughts, anything you'd like to say, with no pressure, just know that people will know instantly if you've gotten it really wrong. They will know immediately.
I mean, is there ever a scenario where I don't believe Alabama's going to win a football game? I mean, the historic record speaks for itself.
I'll take that as your prediction. I predict, on the other hand, that this time the evil empire will go down and Georgia will finally get what's been our rightful inheritance for the last 35 years.
You know, everybody's got their day. So, you know, I like to hedge my bets.
I will go
whatever your mascot is, because I can't remember what it is.
The Bulldogs.
Bulldogs, yes. Go Bulldogs.
See, that hurt worse than anything else.
Sorry. I'm so bad.
Right at the beginning.
I mean, I'm from a school that has like 22 mascots. You'll have to excuse me. My head's full of stuff.
That's fair. That's fair and accurate.
Yeah.
All right. So now that we've gotten that out of the way, Josh, you have spent a lot of time and a career sort of exploring history,
and
individuals' history of certain people. I guess I'd like to start by asking you sort of about your own, like where you're from, where you grew up, what your early life was like, that sort of thing.
Well, I grew up in Anniston, Alabama, which is for the most part, it was a military town, and we had a pretty large military base there, Fort McClellan. I think in a lot of ways, Anniston was both typical and atypical of Alabama because of the influence of the military base. I went to a public elementary school that had people from Korea and people from Germany and people from Spain. And so I had this kind of what I imagined was my total typical Alabama growing up, which probably wasn't in most parts of Alabama. You know, my parents were my mom is they're really both from the South. My mother grew up in Pennsylvania. And so I lived in this household where everything was kind of everything was very open. And so I didn't know that the South and Alabama wasn't a very open place, really, until I got into these sort of upper level conversations when I was older about, well, you know, this really isn't typical, because you get such a skewed version of your own history, like when you live in a place like Alabama. Right. Alabama has never had the luxury of ignoring its racial past. And so because of that, because it's always present, I think my growing up felt a little very different than a lot of people who grew up in Alabama, because we talked about this stuff in my household. Like, we unpacked these boxes a lot. And so I didn't hate being from Alabama. I still don't. And I think I didn't know until much later that I was supposed to. Rather, there's this idea that if I grew up, you know, I would describe my parents as small C conservative, right? So they always vote economically, right? That's what middle-class white people do. They vote with their economics. There was no hate in our house. Like, we learned a lot about that when we were kids. But when I got to be, you know, old enough to know that I was not going to grow up to be a straight white Christian conservative, suddenly all the narrative was, oh, well, you're not supposed to enjoy being from here. And so I never felt that way in Alabama. I never felt unsafe. I never felt like I didn't belong in that space. And granted, this comes with a huge caveat, being a person who has a majority of identities, white, able-bodied, middle class. I went to college, so did my parents. But I think Alabama for me was it wasn't idyllic. It was just sort of normal.
And when you said when you were older, you sort of figured these things out.
Yeah.
That what how other people saw Alabama. Do you remember like sort of how that happened?
Well, so my uncle and my uncle is gay, and his partner were very visible in my growing up life, and so I saw what it was like to see older because you know they were 25 and 30 and 35. These older gay couples sort of had these lives. I just didn't know that it was atypical. And so there was a certain point when I left my parents' home and went to University of Alabama for my undergraduate, and I was having those stirrings about coming out too, that when I did come out, the very first thing people said was, well, where are you going to go now? As if somehow that was the next level. You come of age, you have a sense of self, and then you figure out how to get out. And it was very confusing for me. And I think for a long time, I mean, I lived in Alabama up until 2012 when I moved to Charlotte. And so that whole time trying to make sense of what it meant to feel like I had to escape. And I was just never quite certain what I was escaping from.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you figure this out about coming out and this sort of thing when you were in college or?
No, I knew much younger. I just didn't know what to do about it. Like I was 15 for sure when I had that moment of like, okay, so this is who I am. This is what I'm going to be doing. And then I kept it to myself. But I've said this a lot to people. Part of the reason I kept it to myself wasn't because I was embarrassed of it. I just was so afraid of what happened next. And I just didn't have the nerve to kind of pull the trigger. I mean, if I had come out at 15, which I think I was 15 in like 1989, 1990, that would have been way ahead of my time.
Right.
I mean, I came out at 19, which at the time was like 4 and 5 years before most of my contemporaries were out. And so I knew very clearly who I was. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew who I wanted to be. You know, I wanted to be the person that my parents wanted me to be in a lot of ways, but I needed that version to be sort of tweaked, and I had to kind of figure out how to do that.
And how did that go with your parents once all that?
Really good, actually. I mean, my mom, I think, always had a more difficult time with it than my dad. Like, he was the first person I came out – well, second person I came out to my family. I came out to my grandmother first because I knew she wouldn't have a problem with it.
I was going to say, why your grandmother?
Oh, my God. My grandmother was the most amazing human being on the planet. She grew up in what I would call Olympic level racism, like in her household, right? Like they weren't kidding around. They were for sure about it. And she somehow emerged from this household of like emotional and physical abuse where there was extreme. I mean, my great grandfather was notoriously like leadership level in the Klan, right? And so she grew up in this environment. And then somehow as she matured into an adult, she found a way to let that trauma go. And so she had none of that in her household. There was absolutely no racist slurs in her house. You didn't treat people that way. And so I knew she was the first person I was going to come out to. And what I expected when I came out to her was, you know, to be loved and accepted. What I didn't expect was she was like, okay, all right, great. Have you told your parents? And I said, no, I haven't got around to that yet. And she said, are you seeing anybody? Because I work with the nicest man, you know? And so like, that was her first thought. Like she wanted me to be happy.
Right.
Right. And so here I am at 19 and she's like working with this, you know, 45-year-old nurse practitioner that she wants to set me up with because that's the only other gay person she knows, right, who's single.
I have the other guy.
Right. And you should know this other guy. And I'm like, I mean, we don't have a lot in common yet, but like, give me a minute. So my parents were fine. My dad and I, like, the most Southern butch thing he could think of, like we went on a trip to the hardware store. And then I came out to him on this trip to the hardware store. And he proceeded to he interrogated me about my identity for like the hour that we were gone. I called it in my head the stop sign conversation. So like every time we get to a stop sign, he would like formulate another question.
Right.
And so he was interrogating me in his own very intellectual way, because my father's extraordinarily smart. And so by the time we got done with our trip, like he had it all worked out. He's like, okay, well, here's what we're going to do. And my mom had, at the time I was really angry at her for having like trouble with it. But now that I'm an adult, I understand completely, you know, my uncle's coming out was really traumatic. You know, he came out in the 70s.
And this was in Alabama too?
In Alabama. Yeah. And so for him, it was all dilemma and difficulty and, you know, and all these, he went through all this trauma and she didn't want me to go through all that trauma. So for her coming out, that's all it was. It was, I was going to be unhappy for the next, you know, 80 years of my life. And she didn't want that for me. At the time, I had no perspective and didn't understand why she just wasn't on my team. And she and I had a terrible fight about it. Like one time, a total nasty blowout to which my grandmother intervened. And she was like, okay. And so my grandmother takes me on this little drive around the block. And she says, you're going to have to cut your mother some slack. you've known a really long time. She's known for 20 minutes. You don't get to be a jackass to your mother. And I was like, you're right, I'm sorry. And so she kind of put me in my place. But oddly enough, it was an 80-year-old white Southern Baptist minister that finally brought everybody around. Because my parents, both my parents are in medicine. They're both nurses. And my uncle is HIV positive, and all of his friends were. And so their church wanted to do an HIV outreach ministry, but they knew they were ill-prepared for it. And there was a Southern Baptist minister who worked at a clinic in Birmingham called the 1917 Clinic. And he came to their church to talk to them about what they could do to support people. And he stood in the pulpit of their, you know, Southern Baptist, you know, Church of Anniston, and said, it was actually the first Baptist Church of Sachs. That's actually really the first one. It's very important to Baptists. And he said, if you want to do this, you're going to do this with no judgment. You're going to have to leave all this stuff behind. You're going to have to be actual people living up to your theology if you want to do this. And so when it was over, she goes and talks to him and says, you know, my son just came out and I don't know what to do. And things are really strained with us. And he said, well, is he a good kid? And she's like, yeah. Does he get in trouble? No. Is he, you know, does he open the door for people? Does he help people cross the street? And she said, yeah. And he goes, well, then what's your problem? Like, get on board. Right. And everything was fine after that. And so I have a great relationship with him now. I mean, it's amazing.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And so obviously you went on to become a historian.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, what did you become a historian simply because you liked history, or did this background, wanting to know more about other LGBTQ folks in the South, did that inform it, or did you come to the history first, I guess?
Well, it was, I think like everything in my life, it was sort of it was circular. You know, I always felt like an orphan when it came to history. You know, I was really good at it. Like, it was one of the things I was super good at. I was doing the whole AP thing in high school, and I had a great relationship. My AP history teacher in high school is still one of my favorite people, and she was very challenging. But everywhere I went, there was nothing. Like, there wasn't even a hint of somebody that might have looked like me in any of my history textbooks. And so I always felt kind of orphaned from history. And so when I was coming out, I came out in this kind of sweet spot in the early 90s. It was 1994 when I came out. I came out on Valentine's Day because, you know, reasons. Because I was in love, which is a really ridiculous reason to come out of the closet, but it happened. And so I came out to my friends first. And all of a sudden, I became this kind of like spokes gay for the community, right? And so I got to go to all these classes, and I was talking to people, and I was representing my community in this way that I had no authority to do. I was just articulate. Mm-hmm. and non-confrontational. Like, a friend of mine who I think of as a super radical always said that I look just enough like mainstream people that they might believe me. So I should always use my powers for good. And so I was talking to all these people, but after every one of these talks, no matter how often I did it, no matter where it was, I got asked the same question. These sort of newly out people would say, you know, I want to learn more about like the community and its history. How can I do that? And I didn't have an answer to that question. And so when I went back to graduate school in the early 2000s, I was also looking for an answer to that question. And it sent me down this really amazing, really convoluted, you know, journey to try to figure out what Southern queer history look like, because I could read about Harvey Milk. I mean, I sat in the library at 19 and read all 7 Tales of the City books by Armistead Maupin in a week's time, like sitting in the stacks, inhaling as much history as I get. And I was writing down people's names. Like, I didn't know who Harvey Milk was at 19, so I'm jotting his name down. And I didn't know who Barbara Giddings was at 18, so I jotted her name down. And so I was doing my own exploration. But I said, you know, if I'm going to get serious about doing this kind of work, I need to figure out where this history is. And so I really feel like everything I've done since 2002 to the present has been in this like elongated conversation with myself about what does my own history look like and why don't I have access to it? And if I want it, then it's up to me to find it, because it's happening, but it's not happening at the same level that other history is being studied or explored or protected. And so I was determined that I was going to, you know, find it myself.
Well, and when you started looking, where would you get information?
Well, so in 2002, when I started my graduate program, I went back to UA to get my master's in American Studies, and I was working with Jim Salem, who was the then director of the department, and then Lynn Adrian, who is one of my mentors even now. And I sat down and said, look, I want to do this project about sexuality, but I'm not sure what to do about it. And so they said, well, you know, go and look around and see what conversations are being had right now. So that day, I opened up the Tuscaloosa News, and there was an article on the front page that there had been a sting operation in a local park. Now, this is 2002, so it's a full year before Lawrence v. Texas happens. And so, you know, consensual sex between same-sex people was legalized. It's still illegal at this point. And so there's this whole article about a sting operation, and they arrested like 22 men over the course of a week. And I was like, oh, this is it. Like, this is what I want to do. Like, why is this still happening? And so I started digging into that incident. I was like calling police departments and calling the mayor's office and calling the local news. And I'm like, tell me what you can. And I started chasing this thread. And what unraveled in front of me was this really amazing sort of beautiful and kind of gross history about people sort of making do and then actually making it. And so I kind of just started scratching at that. And I mean, it's a passion for my own local history and sent me down this road where I felt a responsibility to begin teaching. And so the very next semester in the spring, we were to develop a course. And so I went back and looked. They had offered one course before at the University of Alabama in 1993. And it was like an intro to gay and lesbian studies. And so I built a class, which I called Modern Gay America, where I wanted to go back and kind of pull all these threads together. Like, who were the people? What were they doing? And so I built this course out of like snippets and bits and pieces and a couple of history textbooks and the work of some amazing people. John D'Amelio, you know, who was from North Carolina, who did some of the earliest groundbreaking work. And John Howard, who still writes about Southern gay and lesbian history, who had been a graduate of the University of Alabama in the 90s. And so I was building on this tradition of these people that I really respected to sort of create for myself this and for my students this access to their history.
So this is 2003.
Yeah.
But I feel like I still need to ask this question. When you created this class, was there any blowback? Was there any issues on campus or any of that sort of thing?
The one issue that we had was that there were more students who wanted to sign up for the course than we had space for. The course filled up in one day the first time I offered it. So it was 25 students and there was a wait list of like 20. And people kept preparing me. In fact, we sat down and had conversations, myself and Dr. Salem and Dr. Adrian, about how I was going to, what would happen if I got pushback? Like, what if someone was disruptive in a class? And so I was like preparing myself for the worst. But even in a politically charged climate of that early in the 2000s, when things were kind of going the way of queer and trans people, better certainly than the 10 years previous, there was still this kind of fear that it was going to go really badly for me, and it just didn't happen. My students they showed up for class every day. I mean, maybe the one and only time I've taught where my students were not absent. Like, they were there every day, they were prepared, and they asked really smart questions, things I couldn't answer. They challenged me. In fact, I remember very fondly, I had a student in that the second year that I taught it, who was a drag performer. And so we had been talking about drag as sort of a function of LGBT history. And he said, you know, I would love for you to come and see a show. And so I was like, well, why don't we just take the whole class and see the show? And so I go into the department and say, I'd like to take my students to see a drag show. And I remember very clearly Dr. Adrian looking through the file cabinet going, okay, we have a form for that. Hold on. If we don't, we can make it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so like just really pushing those boundaries because my students were pushing me. And it's funny to do a thing that is also self-serving because I was also being fed every single time that we taught a course and every time I found a new collection. And so I worked on my very first archival collection. It was 2008. I'd been teaching Modern Gay America and then a new course called Contemporary Queer Culture since 2003. And so I just taught it as a cycle every year. And so every year I would learn more things and I would find more materials. And so in 08, 09, I decided I wanted to try to build a collection about the University of Alabama. And so we built a collection, which is now called the Miller Stevens Collection, about University of Alabama's LGBT student group history.
And I remember reading there was a gay student union there.
Yeah, they had the first one in the state, right? 1983.
Yeah.
And so they, Elliot Jones, who was their founder, was an undergraduate student at UA, and he got his charter denied and was turned away by the SGA, and his parents hired a lawyer, an ACLU lawyer, that was going to sue the university and say, you can't deny them this charter. And Elliot and his friends had been meeting off campus, you know, for probably a year before they went like full on campus. And so in 1983, the Gay Student Union is born. And I wanted to see how much of that history we could recover. And so David Miller, who the collection is partly named after, and then Annabelle Stevens, she was also an advisor. David teaches at University of South Carolina now. And I called him and I said, hey, David, I'm Josh and I'm doing this thing. And he said, I've been waiting for this phone call for years. I have all the stuff you want. It's in boxes in my house. I will mail it to you tomorrow. And so like a week later, these two boxes come and David had kept everything, every piece of paper, every email. At one point in a box, there was even the answering machine from the first like student space they had. Which I remember plugging in, and like my students didn't know what an answering machine was at the time. They'd never seen one with a tape in it.
Right.
And so I remember I plugged it in and the tape rewound and we listened to it. And it was myself and three of my students. And we sat in my office like weeping, listening to these sort of voices, you know, not from the distant past, like from 1983. Like historically, that's like 10 minutes ago.
So what was on the tape?
Just these like sort of pleading calls about like, I need, you know, I heard that you guys were an entity, like I need your help, or I'm living in Baldwin County in South Alabama and there's nothing here. Is there something you guys can help me with? And people saying thank you for being visible. And just like all these moments that were captured that don't exist anyplace else. And I suddenly realized like, the enormity of what we had done. Like, holy crap, like if we don't start collecting this stuff and putting this stuff together, then it's gonna be gone forever. And it really lit a fire under me about doing this kind of work in a much faster pace than I was doing before.
When we come back, Josh Burford talks about coming out as a political act, whether people intended to be or not. That and lots more, still ahead on this episode of Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
It sounds like you have some limitations or some challenges that maybe researchers in other areas don't have, and that at least maybe when you started, maybe it's different now, not as many books and that sort of thing. You're doing like kind of what, oral histories or interviewing people, or how are you gathering stuff?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. And we're the bulk of the work is collecting the physical material. So like finding it, preserving it, organizing it, and then making it available. Like that is primary concern number one, because, you know, papers, manuscripts, even ephemeral pieces like t-shirts and books, they have a very particular shelf life unless they're kept in the correct way. And that's what archivists do, right? To preserve it forever. Oral histories are really good to add the nuance, right? So like a box of material is good all on its own for a researcher, but the oral history is a really beautiful part of that nuance. The dilemma with both is I don't know that it's changed that much. I mean, if you think about the number of gay men who died in the 1980s in that first like rush of HIV infections, like we lost a generation of community leaders and activists and even just regular people all within the span of a decade. And all of their collections, for the most part, you know, didn't make it. In Charlotte, for instance, we found a story of a local real estate agent who was that his job was to sort of resell these houses, right? Because people at that time didn't want to even live in homes that people who had AIDS like had died in, right? Because people didn't know, quote unquote, how you were infected. And so entire homes were just backed into trash cans and then burned. What? So we lost all that stuff. And then just plain old neglect, right? The idea of like, well, this is not important. And so it just gets thrown away. So that's always a present danger when you do LGBT history. And so the oral histories are there. But the problem with oral histories is both functional and then because of the medium. Like people don't want to tell you the really bad things when you're talking to them, right? Like oral histories have a tendency to be very sunny. Even the sad ones are still pretty sunny. And so when you're doing oral histories, there is a real technique to sitting down and trying to get that nuance out of people because you need that stuff. You need the pain and the happy all at the same time to kind of bolster them. And we're losing them all the time. I mean, so here locally, I've told the story before, but Donaldson King, who was so important to the organizing of Charlotte's LGBT community, you know, he died a week before his oral history was supposed to be taken. Ugh. And so now what? You know, he left us an amazing collection. The man kept everything. It's beautifully preserved. And so we have his things. But the only two voice recordings we have of him are on my cell phone because I recorded all of our conversations. And so, like, what do you do then? Right. Because we weren't in an oral history studio. We were in a restaurant in Plaza Midwood, you know.
Right. So it counts for something, but it's not quite, probably the researcher standard.
Exactly.
Historian standard of what.
And if you think that the first LGBT history textbook came out in the mid-1980s, like, that should tell you what it's like to study something like this, right?
Right.
I mean, I looked because I was curious, but there are thousands of books about Lincoln and, like, less than 100 books about queer history. So what does that tell you?
Tell me you need to get on the
slide. I know, exactly. I've got to stop being so lazy, right, and get to work, yeah.
Well, I remember one story about maybe once you had come to Charlotte, you had found, like, an invitation to a party.
Yes.
So, like, tell
so I was volunteering at the LGBT Community Center, and I was just, you know, cleaning up or whatever, and I found this it was a folder, and it said, like, history, and there was, like, a little question mark, as if someone didn't know if it was historical or not, which that's valid, right.
But as a researcher, you're like, that's making you feel great.
That's great. I'm like, good. Someone kept a file. But I found it's an invitation to a fundraiser for Bill Clinton that was being held in Charlotte in the early 90s.
And you found this in 2000.
This was 2012.
Yeah.
And so I pulled it out and I'm thinking, wow, this is really nice. Like, you know, it was well designed. But then when I flipped it over on the back, the entire back of the card was just individual community people's names who were, you know, giving their time to this Clinton fundraiser. And it was an LGBT fundraiser specifically. And so here's this whole list of people. And so that list started the entire Charlotte project.
Right.
In fact, in a lot of ways, it really started this new project I'm going to work on in Alabama, because it showed me, like, my own limitations of what I was thinking of as historical documents, right? That maybe an invitation on its face doesn't seem worth keeping, but this invitation created a whole project, because those individuals were the seeds that helped me find out about individual history and bar history and drag history and organizational histories, all kinds of things, just because it was in that one spot.
So basically you took that list and just tracked those people down.
Yeah, and went on the hunt. And so I have my own sort of style about how I do this stuff. And so I made a list of the people that I absolutely wanted to talk to. And then I made a list of people that I knew I could get really easily. And then I made a list of people that my white whale list, like the people who would have so much information that it would keep me busy for years. And so I just tracked them down one at a time and made phone calls and looked up old email addresses and backtracked old AOL accounts, you know, to find out where these people were now. And social media helps, certainly, because you can farm some of that out. But I think because of that, because Charlotte, the way Charlotte's LGBT history has been organized, just, you know, just because of the way that it is, the project itself ran a lot smoother and a lot faster than it probably would have if I had started it, you know, in, like, Meridian, Mississippi, for instance,
right,
where everything's kind of quiet and spread out. You know, Charlotte had, the queer community here is still very visible, but there was a sort of heyday of the project, you know, the movement in the 90s when, you know, Jesse Helms made a beautiful enemy for people, right? He was so clear and crisp as an enemy. And then the Angels in America controversy in 95, a very clear marker. 92, the fight with the city to create an anti-discrimination statement. These very clear markers in time, right, that we were able to sort of build a historical record around these moments. And then that record sort of grew past and future in both directions simultaneously.
Yeah, for people who don't remember, and for people who are not from Charlotte, I remember that Angels in America thing especially, where some local politicians were upset because Angels in America was produced here. It had gay themes and there was nudity.
Yes.
So it, like, rang all the bells.
Right.
And so there was that. You're right. I think it galvanized people for and against here and forced that debate to happen. And so what you're saying is a lot of the history that you found sort of coalesced around some of those moments.
It did. And I mean, really, Charlotte had, for me, I mean, its most visible political moment for LGBTQ folks in that decade, like in that 90s decade. And so that story is, for a lot of people, both in and outside of Charlotte, was like this moment. Like, this is, and I think a lot of people imagine as an atypical Southern queer moment, right? Like, here's where we stood up and pushed back, which is not really a narrative that you hear very much. There's, for me, the two narratives of queer Southern living are escape which is a narrative that I learned very early, and then mitigation. And so, you know, it's your job when you come of age, if you can, to leave to these theoretical places where it's better. Urban, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, et cetera. And so that was our narrative. And that's true of a lot of people in Charlotte who left in the 70s. But then there's this other narrative that we don't hear, the return narrative. And so much of what happened in the 90s is because, like, Charlotte brothers and sisters, men and women, left in the 70s, learned, and then came back because they needed to come home. The family called them home, or their desire to be back south called them home. And then they invested in their communities. And so you don't hear that return narrative at all. And I am so impressed constantly with these narratives of people coming back who are like, I learned this thing. Let's go home and plant the seed and see what happens.
It's like some version of the Great Migration.
It is, exactly. This sort of great queer migration, right? That we, and then, because again, the other narrative, the narrative of mitigation, was one where there were no winners. Like, if you stayed, then when you stayed in one very particular, very small part of the South. And so what I've said all along, and we were actually talking about that this week, like, there is an economics of queer identity that is okay if you stay in the South. So if you're an African-American gay man, then you're okay being African-American gay when you're a worship leader or you do music, right? And gay white men were florists and hairdressers, and they stayed in those jobs because that's where they were allowed and the only place they were allowed to be themselves.
That movie Bernie. I don't know if you saw the guy in Texas, you know, and it made me think that especially, and you feel free to tell me if I'm way off base about this, that especially in the small towns in the South, although I'm probably true in other places too, there were some people who were out. There were probably a large number of people who were closeted.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was that third category that you're talking about, that they were, for some reason, maybe because they were really good at playing the organ in the church,
right,
or whatever, they had some civic role that other people didn't fill well,
mm-hmm.
that they were sort of accepted but not approved of in a way.
Right.
I mean, does that feel like...
Yes. And I mean, there is such an interesting thread about the economics of identity in the South. The places where you were allowed to thrive because you were offering the community a thing it couldn't get anyplace else, or you did a thing so beautifully that you were rewarded by being allowed to exist. And this narrative is, I mean, it permeates the queer South everywhere, small towns, large towns. I mean, much of that stereotyping of gay men and women, right, that gay men are artsy and gay women are crafty and this sort of thing, right? Like, all that is built on an economics. If you did this thing, you stayed in your lane, then you got to be, and you didn't, I mean, successful is difficult. But the closet, I mean, my God, like, the closet itself is so complicated because it has defined the community for, you know, 100+ years. This idea that the closet is not a one-way trip, that, to your point, some people are sort of in and out simultaneously. Like, people know that you're that way, right? Like, all these euphemisms. One of the ones I could never understand was someone asked me one time if I had sugar in my tank. Like, I don't even know what that means, right? Like, I'm sweet, like, I'm nice.
Yeah.
I remember this really hateful girl in my high school asked me if I had sugar in my tank. I didn't know what she was talking about.
I'm not sure she knew what she was talking
She
about.
She probably wasn't, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, all these ways in which the closet was totally colonizing for gay people. It gave us a definition that smothered us. You know, it limited us. And then when we came out, like, and I think this is the thing we don't talk about enough, the coming out story in the 70s was not a personal story. Like, people came out, it was a political decision. So you came out as yourself. So I came out as Josh. Then I would also come out as a policeman or a doctor or a teacher or a lawyer. And so you were taking back spaces that belong to you. And so you came out as an extension of, no, you know, gay people, because I'm sitting right here and I'm also a lawyer and I'm also a bus driver. And so you came out as a political act. And so it gave us so much power to be who we were in those spaces and at home. Like, I'm your son and I'm also trans, or I'm your son and I'm also bi. Like, all these things happening, we were taking up space that we had been denied. And then I don't know what happened, but the coming out story has now become a story about the self and less about the community. And in a lot of ways, I don't know what function it still serves. I mean, for me, my coming out narrative is a clear line of demarcation in my mind between who I was and who I am. And even that is not really fair. because who I was, I still am in a lot of ways.
I would think maybe it's at least some small sign of progress that it doesn't, in some areas, doesn't have to be as political anymore. Certainly, I think in some areas, like, for example, when there was this debate over trans in the military, and then some trans people came out and said, I've been in the military for 20 years, and I'm already here. There are other people like me here. That's obviously a political act in some way. But maybe it's not, I don't know, maybe it's not as necessary in other fields, or maybe it's just, you're right, that people are more kind of naturally turning inward and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm of two minds about the whole thing, because I actually don't think there's anything that you can do as a queer person in our culture that isn't political.
Right.
I mean, people say, oh, I came out and it wasn't a big deal. Okay, that's great. But now that you've come out, when's the last time you held hands with your partner at the Epicenter and felt totally okay with that? Yeah. Or when's the last time you were at Concord Mills and you're buying a present for your partner and that didn't feel like a conversation you had to navigate? And so, like, the smallest activities that straight people take for granted are still really political for LGBTQ folks. It just, that's just the way that it is. And yet we have lost a sense of what, I feel like we've lost a sense of what we can do, not what we should be doing.
One of the things that strikes me about the work that you've done, the research that you've done, is that it certainly is about, you know, groups and movements and that sort of thing, but it also feels very personal in the sense that you're writing about people and their specific histories. And I guess I'm just wondering if there are one or two that have sort of, you know, really stuck with you. Oof. Or when you think about people that you know, have interviewed or studied, maybe even people who have long passed and you found out about their history.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a big ask. I mean, to pick only two, but...
Well, we'll work on it.
I think one of the stories that we've uncovered with the help of some colleagues on the West Coast is the story of Maxine Perkins.
Charlatan,
yeah. And so she was a trans woman in the 60s. She was described in the newspaper as notorious. And I mean, I think at the time what they meant was that she wasn't ashamed.
Right.
It was, you know, the idea. And so she was a lot of things. I mean, she was someone's sister. She was, you know, someone's friend. But she was able to come to a sense of her identity as Maxine in a time where trans identity was ephemeral at best and really only existed in sort of dark spaces. And you just didn't see trans people. And so she's arrested outside of a bar in Uptown for engaging in consensual sex with someone that she had just met. And they go to court, and the guy that she was with pleads guilty immediately. Like, he's ashamed and embarrassed. And they're going to print his name in the newspaper, which they always did when people were arrested.
Sure.
As a way of shaming. And so he got like 5 months suspended sentence, probation, and community service. And so her turn comes, and she's sitting, you know, behind the defendant's desk, and the judge keeps saying, you know, Max, do you have anything to say? And so he's misgendering her and then dead naming her in court, and she doesn't answer. And then he says, Max, 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 all these times. And then finally, when he realizes she's not going to respond, he says, Maxine, do you have anything to say for yourself? And she says, actually, yes. And so she sits there, right, like potentially one of the most vulnerable populations at the time, and stands up for herself and denies that she did anything wrong, that there was anything incorrect or immoral about her behavior, that her name was indeed Maxine and they should spell it correctly in the newspaper. And she gets sentenced to like 35 years to life in prison. And so she serves, because at the time in North Carolina, there were two sentences for sodomy, right? So, you know, sex and same-sex people. One was the death penalty, which hadn't been used since the colonial days. And then the other was life in prison.
So those were your choices.
Those were your choices, death or life in prison, right? For a lot of people, the same sentence, really. And so she goes to prison, to a men's prison. And then a few years later, a group recovers her story. They find a judge in Asheville and bring it to him. And he says, this is ridiculous. No human should get this kind of sentence for what should be at best potentially a misdemeanor. And so her sentence is vacated. She's retried and then found not guilty. And so just in those 3 years, she was not a trailblazer. She wasn't an activist. She was trying to make it. She was trying to get people to use her correct pronouns. She's trying to get people to use her name. And she becomes this, for me, I mean, for a lot of people, this sort of flashpoint for all the ways we were wrong about our own history, that these people didn't exist. It turns out they do. It turns out they had difficult lives and bad things happened to them and they persevered. And Maxine's story to me is just, it's a constant reminder of all the things that I don't know. And we're still finding out stuff about her. And so again, that idea, right, that story existed, it's a Charlotte story, but the narrative lived someplace else. And we were able to bring that back to the South. And now I hope use that story to inspire young trans people to like see like what is possible. These are what your ancestors look like. This is what they were doing, and do that with them.
Do you feel like in your research, or you know, just from what you've read now, that it really is more difficult to be gay, trans, queer in the South than it is in other places? Like, if you are growing up in a small town in Alabama, is it really harder than if you're in a small town in Minnesota, say?
I mean, my impulse is to say no. I think a lot of the imagining of how more difficult it is in the South is just marketing, right? I mean, you and I both know that the South exists as this sort of foil, right? Like we're the reason why people want to live in New York. We're the reason why people want to live in San Francisco, because you don't want to live in the South where like segregation and racism happens, right? And then you look at the data and Boston is more segregated. Chicago is more segregated than Montgomery, Alabama is, or Charlotte, North Carolina. Right. So we know, Southerners know in our heart-shaped spaces that the narratives aren't true, that we exist as the counterpoint to things that are going well.
Yeah.
And God knows we give people plenty of fodder. I mean, I say this as a person who was in Alabama during the Roy Moore election campaign fiasco. There's plenty there, but there's so much more nuance to that story, to every story about the South. And I don't think it's harder. I think that the South offers its own kind of difficulties. You know, if you live in Alabama, your town probably has more churches than doctors. So that is just a functional truth of a lot of places. If that is true, then you have difficulties coming to your sense of self because of that reality. But this generation coming out younger, right? And when I came out at 19, I was early. This generation's coming out at like 12 and 15. But they are still coming out into a world that resembles the world that I came out in the 90s. They don't have community centers. Their phones, which are supposed to give us access, don't have their history in them because it doesn't exist there. And so I think that's true everywhere. I mean, you can get trans people will tell you, because they experience this every day, that they are just as at risk walking in the West Village in New York as they are walking in Birmingham, Alabama. That's just the truth. And people don't want to see that, because if we have work as a community, and the queer community has plenty of work to do for and of itself, if that reality is true all of the places, then the narrative completely falls apart. Then why would we leave? Like if, to your point, it's just as difficult in Topeka, Kansas, as it is in the Black Belt of Mississippi, then what is the difference in living in those two places? If you live in Mississippi and you fight for what is yours in that place and you have access to your family, then doesn't that seem better than being a stranger in a city of a million people that would never let you come to terms with who you are? It's just a different kind of isolation.
Yeah. And now you're going back to Alabama.
Yes, I can't wait.
And it's called the Invisible History.
The Invisible Histories Project of Alabama is right. The new project. Yeah.
And so kind of explain how this all came about.
Well, so about 3 years ago, I was talking to some friends back in Alabama, and my friend Megan Sullivan, who's in Birmingham, she's amazing. She and I were chatting one day, and she said, when you get ready to come home, we got to do something like this in Alabama, the way you're doing it. And I said, well, what would it look like? And so we started brainstorming what a project like this might look like. And Megan and I said, what should we call it? And I said, we should call it the Invisible Histories Project with an S, because there are so many histories that we don't know. And everyone said I was nuts to even think about it. Like, you want to go back to Alabama? You want to do what in Alabama? Are you sure? Is that even a thing? And every day that I felt like I couldn't do it, I had someone to tell me, oh, yeah, you should totally do that.
Yeah. Now, what you've already obviously started doing some of this research and some of the other folks. And I know we were talking beforehand. You found stuff as early as like the early part of the last century.
Yeah, 1912.
So what in 1912?
So there's a man named Patrick Cather. He is an LGBT community member in Birmingham, an organizer and a writer. I think it was in the middle 1990s, was at a thrift store and found a diary, sometimes called a chapbook, that he thought was beautiful, and he picked it up and he took it home. And then a year goes by and he opens it up to read it. And what does he finds that the author of this book was writing from 1912 into the 1950s about his life as a gay man who came back from the First World War, who was from Birmingham, Alabama. And he writes these diary entries, poetry, musings about his relationships in Alabama. And he's like, oh my God, what have I found? And it is in beautiful shape. It is wonderfully preserved. And the prose that's in this is heartbreaking and beautiful and gorgeous. I actually brought some. Can I read some to you?
Oh, absolutely.
So there was a poem in this book. It's called 11-741. And so he was, the author of this book was writing about his past relationships and who these men were. And so this one has always really stood out to me. It's, I am a fool for trying to return down all the lanes that lead to yesterday. I raise my drink and shyly stand alone and search my heart for memories of you. Remembering the nights we made our own, remembering a dreamy rendezvous, when people turned their heads to watch you pass and wine was on your lips and in my glass. I mean, that is intense stuff, right? Like this level of love and affection that was being experienced in this time of, I mean, of great repression for the community, that this exists to me is proof that there's so much amazing work to do. And that this man who, I mean, he had no way to be out in the 20s. That wasn't a thing then. He wrote this down so that someone could read it. And so here's this time capsule.
It's like it's written down just for you guys.
For us. I know. I feel in some ways that when Patrick rediscovered this and then wrote about it, that he was preserving this time capsule, this gift, to remind us that our history goes back as far as there were humans. And we have to be brave enough to ask the tough questions and to look in unexpected places and then find it. Because I'm telling you right now, every single piece that we collect is not just a win for preservation, right? There's these people that just want to preserve for the sake of preservation. Every one of these stories that we preserve is an example to a 15, 16, 18, 20-year-old LGBT person that they are a part of something so much bigger than the limitations of their current experience. And that if in 1912, with no internet, no community, very little language, I mean, in 1912, when this guy started writing, the word gay wasn't even normal use to talk about the community. We were still homosexuals and sodomites.
I mean, is that 1912? I was going to ask, how did he refer to himself and his, you know?
Well, that he doesn't. That's the thing. Like, he doesn't have that language. He is a this author from this chat book is just he's talking about the love and ignoring the limitations of calling it a thing.
Right.
He's just talking about how he felt about this man and doesn't have the language to label it. So it doesn't happen.
So it's not clear that whether it was actual relationship or.
Well, I mean, it depends. I think, I mean, it's very clear from the context of the whole book. Oh, so I'm going to read you this one little section here too. This is where things get really like specific, right? And he says, by one sure hand to have been no more alone, but nothing has happened, and the day grows chilly, a cold bed awaits for the going down of the sun. It seems a curious way to have spent a lifetime, strange to be nearing the end of what has never begun. And so he knows who he is. He knows, and by 41, there were at least some blips of visible gay culture. And so when he's sitting down to write this in the 50s, these reflections, he understands himself as a part of something bigger. And luckily for us, he was able to put this down for so long that we were able to kind of now take it apart.
Yeah.
And so that's powerful stuff.
So I guess I'm imagining to kind of bring it all back around.
Yeah.
So you're 15 years old in Aston, Alabama,
mm-hmm.
figuring this out. You're 19 and you're deciding to come out.
Yeah.
At some point you decide to get into history and archives and that sort of thing. How does what you found and what you're doing sort of compare with what you thought your life would be like?
You know, I think when I was in my 20s, I felt like I wanted to do more, but I didn't know what that more was. And I was still trying to grow up. I was still trying to figure that out. It really wasn't until I was in my 30s that I sort of started to understand what it might mean to have this level of purpose. But I'll be totally honest with you. It wasn't until I came to Charlotte that I really started to feel like I could actually do it. That I have been an activist for a long time, and I have marched and I've done my part, and I've yelled at people and I've educated and I've made friends and enemies. But when I came here and started working on this history and saw all of the benefits that came from it, people who would call me in my office and leave me messages that said, I just left your exhibit and thank you so much for letting me know that I didn't live invisibly, right? Or the going to high schools, which is not a thing I ever really did before I came to Charlotte. I mean, I could count on one hand the number of high schools I'd been in the previous 20 years. And since I moved here, I'm in them every other week. And sitting and listening to them ask me questions. I got the highest compliment I've ever gotten when I moved here. And I gave a presentation about activism and to a room about 40, like, middle and high school LGBT kids. And when it was over, the person who was leading the group said, that's the first time they've ever sat still for 45 minutes. And so I'm realizing now the impact that I'm able to have. And so I feel in a lot of ways I feel like I'm paying off a debt to my 15-year-old self, because he was fearless. I mean, terrified and fearless. You know, I had a boyfriend when I was in high school secretly. I had relationships when I was in high school. And I did he did all those things then without any assurance that it was going to go well. And so now that I'm an adult and I have a job and I'm living a life, I feel like I'm paying off that debt to my younger self. Because he was so not afraid. And so what the hell am I afraid of now? If he wasn't afraid, then I definitely don't need to be afraid now. And so I appreciate in a way that I didn't before, like, that what I went through was necessary for me to be able to be the person that I am now, and to be constantly self-reflective and to be constantly aware of whose history I don't get to see. And the gaps, the fact that bisexual history is so difficult to find, that trans history is wildly overlooked, that queer people of color's history is not present in a way that it should be. And so I have a responsibility now, and I'm excited about the responsibility.
Josh, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
One more thing.
Yeah.
Go Dogs.
Roll Tide.
Thank you. The thing that struck me the most about my conversation with Josh was when he talked about the accepted options for LGBTQ people in the South. It wasn't that long ago that if you were gay in a Southern town, it was okay to be the florist or the piano player in church. But if you strayed outside those narrow boundaries, it was dangerous. And if you were trans, for example, maybe you had no options at all. It made me think about how much potential we've wasted over the years due to prejudice. Not just prejudice against LGBTQ Southerners, but also Black Southerners and Brown Southerners and female Southerners and other minorities of all types. We have surely lost out on legions of engineers, political leaders, artists, even astronauts. People who could have done astounding things had they been given the chance. Things are better now, but too many Southerners are still wearing blinders that don't let them see a whole human being. And as long as that happens, we're losing out on our greatest natural resource, our people. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our theme music comes from Josh Turner. If you have any thoughts about the show, ideas for future guests, or predictions for which SEC team will win next year's national championship, email me at tomlinsonwrites, that's one word, @gmail.com. By the way, we'll have show notes with links to some of Josh Burford's work on the Southbound page at WFAE.org. And you can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on WFAE.org, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, committed to technology-driven radiation therapy and treatments for cancer. Details at treatcancer.com.